Hello, this is Scott Gents. Welcome to Sandbox Stories. Welcome to this Sandbox Story, which is an interview with industry veteran Ed Buffington. Today, Ed is president and CEO of GPN Technologies, the software company that brings the Edge Pro Practice Data Analytics Dashboard to so many in the eye care field. He's done almost everything in the industry, including being the founder of the OfficeMate practice management software system that became so widely used in the profession. In 2024, Ed has been honored with the Prevent Blindness Person of Vision Award. Ed Buffington, welcome to Sandbox Stories.
Well, thanks, Scott. It's great to be here. I watched most of your podcast, and I'm delighted to participate in one. Thank you.
Well, it's really a great time for you and I to reconnect. We've been friends for, I would suppose, close to a quarter of a century. We became most closely acquainted when we were competitors in the optometry software space. And what I learned from you right away was how willing you were to build friendships with anyone that you believed was doing something positive for the industry. Have you been that way your entire life?
Well, I learned early on, keep your competitors close to you. And yeah, the answer is sure. I learned that having friends and relationships was the most important thing in life. I learned that from a small child to playing Little League baseball, and certainly that carried over to my professional career. So absolutely, there's no such thing as an enemy. And I'm proud to say, I think in the eye care industry, I only have one or two people that don't like me. We won't go into those stories, but there are very few because there's no reason for that kind of relationship with anyone.
Well, what I learned was how many people knew you, how gracious you were to each of them that you met, how professional you were. And I certainly tried to make sure that I emulated that. And you were very gracious to me. And that's why I'm glad we're friends. And so now let's go all the way back to the farm where your family life started. You grew up in Carroll County, Maryland, on a rural country farm. Paint that picture for us.
Well, I was a little country boy. I mean, running around without shoes on and working in the fields. And my father was a radio disc jockey, but he was also a gentleman farmer. And unfortunately, he didn't have time to do all the work himself. So what he did, he taught me at a very early age, like 11 years old, to drive a tractor. So they would literally put me in the field in the tractor at 6 a.m. in the morning, and they would bring me lunch and come and get me around 4:30 or 5. So here I am, an 11-year-old kid with a tractor and a plow or a disc harrow on the back, driving in a field all day long by myself. So, God forbid something happened, no one would find me until lunch or dinner. And it was really a country existence in every way, shape, and form.
What was your schooling like? How far away were schools from where you lived?
I went to a Catholic high school 13 miles. So my stepmother would drive me to and from school when we were in school. And during the spring and summer, I would play baseball, Little League baseball, for a couple of hours. So, it was in retrospect, a very good living. In those days, I didn't think so because I worked so hard. I learned to work incredibly hard as a young man. But in retrospect, it really wasn't a bad living or lifestyle.
Did you have any siblings? Did you do any other activities, any other interesting parts of that childhood and upbringing?
Yeah, I had a young brother, and he and I shared a lot of the responsibilities, and we got along most of the time, not all the time. We typically, two young brothers fight, and we certainly had our fights, but it was good.
So your dad was known as a radio guy. Tell us about Charlie.
Charlie was a radio disc jockey, and he was very popular. He did what they called the morning drive time. He would sign on at 5 a.m. and go to 10 a.m. And again, being in the country, people listened to him. And I mean, he was sort of this mini little god in the mornings on WHVR in Hanover, Pennsylvania. It was quite fascinating. So my name, the name Buffington, became very popular because people knew Charlie Buffington, which is why I go by C. Edward. My first name is Charles, but I go by, no one ever called me Charles because of Charlie. No one would ever, you know, they didn't want to associate me with Charlie, apparently.
And you weren't a junior. You weren't Charlie Junior.
No, I'm the second. My great-grandfather was Charles Edward.
So along the way, your dad suffered a stroke. Tell us a little bit about how that changed his life.
Well, he had his first heart attack at 39. And he lived a good life, as you can tell. And it was a toll on his life. So after the heart attack, we were all challenged to help him because he was paralyzed on the right side of his body. And being the radio disc jockey that he was, they didn't want to lose that radio personality. So they built a studio in our home on the farmhouse. So he would actually do the broadcast from the farmhouse every morning. And he had a teletype machine. Most people don't know what a teletype machine, but I could hear it in the basement printing out the morning news. And he would be up at 3 or 3:30 down in the basement pulling the news off, and then he would come upstairs and sit in the breakfast nook and eat his breakfast and go through the news and decide what he was going to talk about on his radio show that morning.
Now, he also was a bit of a tech buff, and he was ahead of his time. Tell us that story.
Well, he was a tech buff, always interested in technology. And he also started working as a VP of sales for a book company called Tab Books, T-A-B, and they published electronics books. And he, while he was doing that, he started gaining interest in computer technology. And I think I mentioned he published a book called Introduction to Microcomputers that literally was published and released 2 weeks after he passed away at 51 years old. So he never really got to, you know, see the finished copy of the book. But even to this day, I still have it and read it. And it's pretty remarkable how much ahead of his time this was, because this was in the early 80s.
So you got your hard work ethic from the farm, and you got a little of tech influence from him. You were getting ready to go on to do what's next. You went to college. Tell us what happened there.
Well, I went to a junior college for 2 years, and then the summer after my junior college experience, I went to Towson University. And while there, I met this girl in the, I forget what they call student union, I guess, in those days. And her name was Marcy. And I went, wow, that's a pretty cute girl. So we had lunch together. And, you know, a few months later, she was my girlfriend. And here this woman, the city girl, is taking this old country boy. And I used to drive from my country house down to Baltimore to see her. And that, you know, it was quite an experience. Probably 3 or 4 or 5 nights a week, driving 25 miles from my home on the farm down to Marcy's house in the city.
Makes me think about the country song "Dirt on My Boots" or something like that. You must have been that guy.
Well, I cleaned them off before I went to the city. So I took a shower and cleaned off the boots before I went to the city.
Perfect.
But it was a whole different lifestyle from what I ever knew. And it was certainly a major changing point in my life, that's for sure.
Now, you had gone to college to consider being an educator. You were thinking about being a school principal. What motivated you toward that thinking at that age?
Well, that's an interesting question. I liked being around students. I liked the whole educational environment. And I really didn't have any other direction. So I thought, look, you know, get into education and become a principal. It's a good lifestyle. You have the summers off. And, you know, it just seemed to be sort of a natural thing that I would enjoy doing. And it wasn't until my student teaching experience that I realized that teachers didn't make any money. It was, I think back then they quote, you know, they said, yeah, if you're successful and after you're tenured, you'll make $19,000 a year. And I went, what? $19,000 a year? So that during my student teaching experience, I said, nope, this is not for me. I'm going to look for an alternative, which is how he ended up working for my dad at Tab Books as a field sales rep, my first sales experience.
So tell me a little bit about that that girlfriend, Marcy. What came of that?
Well, we married in 1974 when we graduated from college. And here we are today with four kids and six grandkids. And it's been 50 years this year that we've been married. So very interesting. That's another story altogether, another interview.
Okay. We can save it for another time. So you said you shifted to sales. I think sales is something that some people can do and some cannot. What skill had you had that allowed you to do it well as you entered that realm?
Well, I think you sort of pointed to it earlier, people skills. You know, if I think anybody can sell if you have great people skills and if you learn the product, and I don't think there's any magic to selling and hard work. I mean, selling, you know, you just don't walk in and close every sale. There's a lot of small aspects of selling that are critically important. But being a people person, I think, is the most critical person. Having a good product is important. You know, all throughout my career, I've been very fortunate in having great products to sell, and, you know, OfficeMate being one of them. That's another story for another time, right?
I might take you further down into that one before we're done. My brother-in-law has been in sales his whole life. One thing I learned from him when I first met him is at a family reunion, he would remember the aunt's name and the third cousin's name. Did you have that skill? Do you have that ability to just drop somebody's, you know, face and a name together just like that?
Yeah, absolutely. People are amazed and, you know, how you can remember so many names. Now, as I age, that gets a little bit harder, but certainly throughout my career, I could walk a Vision Expo show floor and, you know, hundreds and hundreds of names, and certainly a face I never forget. Sometimes now I have to work a little bit harder to connect the face with the name, but no, that is certainly a very important skill as well.
So you went from books to contact lenses somewhere in the late 70s. What was that jump about? How did that happen?
Well, I met an amateur radio publisher while selling books for my dad, and he wanted to start a book club. So he said, look, you know, here's a great salary. And it was, I think, 50% more than my dad was paying me, but he was up in Greenville, New Hampshire. So he said, okay, you got to move up to New England and you can run the book club for me. So Marcy and I left Baltimore, and it must have been 76, and moved up to New England and spent a couple of years up there. And I built his book club. And so that's how that transition occurred. However, after 4 or 5 years, Marcy said, life up here is awful. It's cold. It's freezing. It's snowy. It's like Milwaukee, you know, or Wisconsin. She said, I'm not happy. I'm going back to Baltimore. If you want to stay here, you stay here. I'm going to Baltimore. So we decided mutually to go leave New England and move back to Baltimore. And when I went, so really I had no job down there. And Marcy's brother, Stephen, had been working for, he was a CPA, he was working for an optometric practice. And he said, hey, this company called American Hydron has an opening for a contact lens sales rep. Why don't you interview? So I did, and got the job as a contact lens rep for Hydron in the Baltimore, Washington, and Northern Virginia area.
So some of the audience won't know what you're talking about. What were the products you were selling back then? Was it 04s? I mean, what were you selling?
The Hydron Mini, the Z4, the Z6. Yeah. Yeah. If you're, you know, 60 or older, you'll probably recognize those names and know of American Hydron. But certainly the younger ODs probably have no idea who American Hydron is.
And these were vial contact lenses, soft lenses, being sold one bottle at a time, right?
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
What a different day. So it's interesting that your connection into the eye care space came from somebody working in an eye care practice. Something I've gotten to know about you over the years is that you've always espoused that in a practice, the network that you have with reps and industry companies matter. And here your brother-in-law doing accounting work for a practice connects you into the industry that you stay in for the bulk of your career. That's correct. Super interesting. You guys got thinking about doing something more for optometrists through software at that point. Was that right?
Yeah. What happened, I was sitting in Washington, D.C., literally across from the White House, one Friday afternoon, and I went in and talked to Atlantic Optical was the name of the practice. And I'm talking to the OD that I had gotten to be very friendly with there. And while I'm talking to him about toric lenses, he's ignoring me. And I thought, why aren't you talking to me? He goes, I'm handwriting recall cards. I said, Marvin, what are you doing handwriting recall cards? He said, it's the most important thing I could be doing other than seeing patients. I said, tell me more. So he said, look, recall is the most important part of my practice. I said, but the only thing you can do is handwrite recall cards. He said, what I do, I put them in a box, and each month I have a little divider. So I pull them out in 2 months ahead of time. I handwrite the recall card and mail them out. So that evening, I went back to Marcy's parents' house. We had dinner with them every Friday evening. And Stephen and I, Stephen's the CPA and sort of the brains behind, you know, the operation, so to speak. And we started talking about, there's got to be something that could help this guy out. And in, I think it was 1980, Time's Man of the Year was the Apple computer. So that evening sort of gave birth to this whole concept of what became OfficeMate. And this was 1981, 82. And in 83, we actually did OptiFair in New York and introduced OfficeMate with 13 screens, no software behind it, just screens. But that was the that was the kernel of, you know, how OfficeMate started. It was a dinner conversation.
That's a really fast time. I mean, you did mock-ups asking doctors what they might want, recall being one of those functions. Do you remember what other functions you were promising the software would have?
Well, scheduling, obviously, billing, internal marketing was a big thing for us because, you know, doctors had, you know, thousands and thousands of files, but no way to communicate with them about new products. It was demographics, insurance, recall, internal marketing, billing, scheduling, all the fundamental things that are really common sense, at least they were to Stephen and I, because, you know, he had worked in an optometric practice in a CPA role, and I was calling on OD. So, you know, the two of us had a lot of commonality among, you know, what's needed in a practice. And in those days, there wasn't much to compare it to. So we were very lucky.
Right. There were no computers in most businesses, much less healthcare practices. So you were ahead. How did the name OfficeMate come to be? Who takes credit for that?
You know, that's a good question. As I recall, when you think about when you're working in an office, it's a mate, it's a helper, it's someone there to assist you. That was really the fundamental sort of thought behind it. And in those days, we were going to do podiatry, we were going to do optometry, so we could take OfficeMate and call it Eye Care OfficeMate, Dental OfficeMate, Podiatry OfficeMate. We could plug any other name along with it, and it would work. And, you know, to the average, you know, person sitting in there doing all the meticulous things they do, it's a mate to help them out.
That's perfect. Did you raise money? Did the two of you just shovel some money together? Did you leave your contact lens sales job? What were those early days at OfficeMate like?
Yep. Nope. I resigned. I quit OfficeMate, and I quit Hydron, and we took home equity. Stephen had a home. I had a home. We used home equity. We didn't raise a dollar or a penny or a nickel. We absolutely funded all the development and everything ourselves. We bootstrapped it, so to speak.
That's a really important point for so many people that don't understand these many great ideas that came into the profession. People took these, I mean, substantial financial risks, personal financial risks, as you did. What were those early years like? Were you going to trade shows to ask people to try your computerized software? How did you get people to take it? Because, I mean, eventually it snowballed and it really started becoming the leader.
Well, I guess for the first year, we were in the development mode, design and development of the software. In 84, Marcy and I packed up the car and took our parents with us. And we came to California, of all places, started up north and came down the state. And I sold 12 systems in that one trip. And we were literally unknown at that point. No one had ever heard of us. So I go carrying these big IBM PCs in and tall grass hard disk. And I did the demo in those days, the hardware and the software, we sold for $12,000, believe it or not. And so, you know, that was a good trip for us and really provided the foundation for building the business going forward. And as you know, word of mouth was important. You know, we provided outstanding service, and those 12 systems that we sold in California sort of multiplied in the next year two or three times from people that, you know, saw the vision of what a computer system could do for them. And they called us up, and we were busy. We got busy very quickly.
Off to the races, as they say.
Off to the races, yep.
So as OfficeMates providing all these practice management functions, being the mate of the person doing the work, at some point, the industry starts to think that it might, like medicine, move toward electronic medical records, either in or attached to these practice management software pieces. So you end up developing with some folks something called Exam Writer. They get conjoined. What was the genesis of putting the medical record with OfficeMate?
Well, one of the frustrations that I always had was, you know, there was no stickiness to the software. You know, the doc could say, oh, here's a cheaper product, Susie or whoever, change to this software. And I met an OD named Dr. Lori Lippiet. And she said to me one time, you know what you need? You need a medical record attached to this, because if the doc is using it, he's less, you know, there's no incentive for him to change because he has to learn a whole new EMR. And, you know, in the beginning, I sort of discounted that, thinking, yeah, right. But, you know, she kept sort of beating me over the head, saying, listen to me, I'm telling you, you've got to develop an EMR as a part of OfficeMate. So sort of that was the kernel of Exam Writer. And she and Dr. Frank Puzio and Dr. Kim Castleberry, and we had five docs that we called our alpha team. So we would get together with them and design what became Exam Writer.
Roughly what year did you start promoting it into the market as you did that build up?
Well, the Exam Writer came after the first version of OfficeMate. Again, another story for a later time. But this was probably around 1993, 94 is when Exam Writer really was launched into the marketplace.
And I've said often in my sandbox stories that my home tilts a little bit toward the south because I live a few miles away from the largest EMR company in the world, Epic Software, which is hospital-based, right? And it's just over there. And that was something that as patients, those of us that live in Madison, Wisconsin, were having our healthcare providers use in the 90s. But I would guess that Exam Writer had to be one of the first, if not the first, medical records for optometrists. How did that shake out? Where were you in that that race to be there?
Yeah, for optometry, we were certainly, if not the first. You know, there were a few other small companies dabbling in it, but OfficeMate was certainly the leader in both practice management software and in medical record software. And, you know, convincing an OD that they needed an EMR was, as you can imagine, quite a challenge back in those days. It was pushing a noodle up the hill for sure.
Now, you ended up finding some success with your company by making sure that anybody that was providing eye care or optical customer service would consider OfficeMate. So you went to places that did what we today call more corporate environment eye care. I know here in Wisconsin, you were very friendly with the Wisconsin Vision folks and others. That was a big part of your success, wasn't it?
Yeah, that came through acquisitions. We bought a company called Delta, and Delta was Wisconsin Vision was using Delta. So yeah, that piece of software launched us into more of the retail side of the business. But, you know, what really launched OfficeMate was a philosophy around Quicken. You know, we started licensing it for $179 a year, which included the license for the software and the support. And, you know, we hit that price point where doctors could say, well, you know what, I don't know if I need it, but it seems affordable. So let's try it. And that was really the secret to the success of OfficeMate, was that low-cost Quicken license fee strategy.
Well, we get to the turn of the century, as they call it. And as part of your company's advancement, you end up finding a partnership with a frame company, Marchand, What were the market forces that led to that partnership?
Well, Alberg, may he rest in peace, always looked up to Mr. Delvecchio at Luxottica. And Luxottica started a software company called EasyFrame. And Al would look at, you know, Luxottica and say, wow, if they're getting into the software business, they know something I don't. So Al came to, well, his partner, Jeff, again, may Jeff rest in peace, came to us and said, look, you're the leader in optometric software. We're interested in acquiring you. And 18 months of negotiation and a lot of pain and agony, we sold to Marchon in 1994. So literally a couple of years after we started the second version of OfficeMate, we were acquired by Marchon Eyewear.
Did that help expand your footprint in getting software into practices where the doctors might not otherwise have been giving software consideration?
Well, it certainly helped the brand. There's no doubt about it. We called it Marchon OfficeMate. So we attached the Marchon Frame brand to our software. And it certainly did help. Quite frankly, not as much as we had hoped, but it certainly did help. And it certainly gave the doctors security in our ability to be a player in the industry, being a part of Marchon. As you probably recall, in those, there were a lot of small software companies that came and went because their ability to sustain the, you know, the business in the market was a challenge. So absolutely, Marchon was a huge contributor to our success in those days.
And a decade later or so, we get to another partnership where Marchon and OfficeMate end up landing in the mothership of VSP. What was that transition like?
Well, that was 2008. It was an interesting transition, needless to say. But for all practical purposes, we were left alone. You know, we did our thing in the software business. And even while we were owned by Marchon prior to the sale to VSP, Marchon really didn't interfere in our business. They were in Long Island, New York. We were here in Southern California. So it was really a hands-off, and we delivered the goods, so to speak. And we were making money and keeping doctors happy for the most part. And so that it was a relatively easy transition for sure.
And I think people don't always consciously digest the fact that VSP has this technology arm, right? Eyefinity. So you were along with the former CIO for Marchon, Jim McGran, and you were over there, and Eyefinity became a thing before Jim moved up higher in VSP. You were taking on new steps in the market, adding new features, trying to deliver new software. That was something that VSP supported through the Eyefinity arm. Is that right?
That's correct. Yep. Very much so.
Got it. So you went through that process. You ended up sort of moving away from software and being an advisor to VSP. What were those last few years there like?
Well, I moved you into role of Vice President Strategic Partnerships. So it was the state associations. I was really a lobbyist, as I felt, in terms of, you know, trying to help people understand what VSP was all about, working with state optometric associations, key influencers in the industry. And it was a wonderful role, leaving the technology side of the world at Eyefinity and moving over into the world of VSP. A whole new learning experience too, for sure.
Well, and you're a personalities person, right? You're a relationships person. So that made sense. Eventually you formed a consultancy and you became an advisor to the founder of GPN Technologies, the founder of the EdgePro Dashboard, our mutual friend, Jay Binkowitz. And I'm curious what you've learned in your time dealing with doctors and industry companies to help them better understand their data. Because as you become the leader of this company, you know that doctors and business owners could do a better job understanding their businesses. Sometimes they just don't take the time to do so. What have you learned?
Well, I've learned a lesson that I learned a long time ago, that if most optometrists would take 2 hours a week and learn more about their business, they could add tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to their business, because they, you know, they're caught up in seeing patients and clinical care, but just learning a little bit about where the opportunities that I can't see in my business, you know, what's my capture rate, you know, so many little KPIs and so many little metrics that if they understood and they can just focus a little amount of time, or even take their office managers and have he or she focus on that, it would make such a huge difference in their practice. And, you know, in my early days at OfficeMate, I couldn't imagine why every ECP wasn't running to spend $179 a year to put in a computer. And I often say, I think I'll go to my grave asking some of these same questions because I've been asking them for 45 years.
Yeah. I mean, you and I talk about this, you know, in our contemporary times together, still today, what it is that my colleagues in optometry, the people you've served your entire career, are feeling is so incumbent upon them to get everything else done, but not really dig into the business. And I honestly really don't know what it is other than sometimes you just take care of patients and at the end of the day, lock up and go back to your family. And the profession is becoming more like that, isn't it?
Well, it goes back to, you know, the Atlantic Optical, when I was selling contact lenses, the doctor sitting there writing recall cards. Instead of saying, you know, to your staff, you write these recall cards, he was sitting there doing it. So there's been some evolution since those days, but not that much. Not that much.
That's a good point. Doctors sometimes doing the things that somebody else could do.
Well, and just not focusing on the critical aspects of that could grow their business substantially.
Yeah. As you've gone through this incredible eye care industry career, who have you found are the mentors that you learned the most from?
Well, you mentioned Jim McGrann, and Jim taught me some very valuable lessons. When he came to Marchand as a CIO, I was like intimidated because Al Berg was talking about this super smart guy, this ex-IBMer, this Anderson consultant. I thought, holy moly, here comes this, you know, guy into Marchand that's going to have something to prove. And I get a call one Friday afternoon. I'll never forget. I'm sitting at home and I answer the phone. He goes, Ed, hi, this is Jim McGrann. And I went, oh my God, now I'm really intimidated. So in that, because, you know, those of you that know Jim, this deep bellowing voice. And as it ended up, Jim would never call me. You know, after he took over as a CIO Marshall, I wouldn't hear from Jim for weeks, sometimes a month at a time. So finally, one morning when he called me, I said, Jim, you know, do we need to do a weekly call? He said, no, why do we need to talk weekly? He said, I'm here anytime you need me. But remember two things, meet or beat your numbers and never surprise me. Meaning, you know, don't surprise him with bad news. So that was really a turning point in sort of my career and learning how to manage people is that put the right people in the right seat, give them their goals and let them run. And Jim was phenomenal to work with because, and even to this day, you know, Jim is a dear friend and a mentor in so many ways.
And a shameless plug to all my listeners, Jim McGrann has his own sandbox story that we did a couple years ago. It's worth a listen. So, Ed, I'm going to tell everybody, go listen to that. Any other folks that influenced you substantially?
Well, you know, needless to say, Jay Binkowitz. When I started my consulting company, Jay was, I had known Jay while I was at VSP because Jay and his partner, Evan, put a table in OfficeMate that would sometimes cause problems. So the guys at Eyefinity said, hey, you know, this company called GPN or The Edge, they're putting tables in the software. So I had to call them up and say, guys, you can't do that. You're causing problems. So that was my first introduction to Jay. And then Larry Roth called me up one day and said, Ed, you've got to call this guy Jay Binkowitz. I said, okay. A week later, Larry called and said, have you called Jay Binkowitz yet? I said, no, I haven't, Larry. He said, you call him right now, which I did. And Jay and I, you know, really struck a very friendly relationship. And those of you know who know Jay know that once you become a friend of Jay's, you're always a friend of Jay's. And he's a remarkable man. And we come from very different backgrounds. And so we, even today at GPN, we're sort of the yin and the yang. We bounce ideas off of each other and we challenge each other on a regular basis. So it's been a phenomenal relationship as well.
And Jay's also a sandbox story. You're right. He's He comes from a different way of looking at eye care businesses, all the businesses he worked on in New York City. Outside of eye care, he brings a different perspective and a powerful guy. How did your family do through this process of being this business person? I mean, you know, it was one of those things. They supported you along the way, I assume.
Yeah, magically and marvelously they did. Yeah, it was, as you well know, as an entrepreneur, you're traveling all the time. And literally many years, I traveled 40 to 45 weeks a year, trade shows, sales conferences, meetings. And so they've been tremendous in supporting me over the years. And that's why, as I contemplate retirement, you know, I think that's my next career. I wear a bracelet called Pops. And I think that's my next career as Pops.
Yeah, I mean, for a long while, maybe you still are, you were kind of at the elite of all Southwest Airlines flyers, right?
Thank God, no more, but yes.
And so now you spend your time with your kids, your grandkids, occasionally one or two of them live in your home like they do in mine, you know, but you're not yet ready for retirement. You know, Pops is out there. Tell us about those loves of your lives, those little ones.
Well, there's six of them, eight ranging in age from 13 to 2. And living in our house, we have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. So I call it 98% of the time, it's a wonderful experience. The 2%, we go, what the heck are we doing? But they're wonderful. And, you know, my other title will be Goober, driving, you know, an Uber, but a Goober driving all the kids to softball practice and to acting and to dance and to all their activities. Because if you take, you know, six grandkids times one or two activities per grandchild, that's almost a full-time job.
Well, what you're doing for them is something that they'll remember and appreciate forever. Let's talk a little bit about getting acknowledgement. Most of us go through our careers for a pat on the back from a patient or a colleague or somebody in the community. You're getting this award, Person of Vision from Prevent Blindness. It's probably one of those things that you shy away from. Knowing you the way I do, you'd always like to pass out, you know, appreciation across the board. But what does it mean to you to get that acknowledgement for a career well done in optometry?
Well, it's humbling, very humbling, because, you know, I've attended every Person of Vision dinner and admired everybody that was on the stage receiving that award, never, ever expecting that I would be that person. So humbling, I'm honored, I'm excited, and it's really a nice culmination to, you know, a 45-year career. So what can I say other than I'm very, very appreciative, but very humble as well.
Well, of course you are. Do you feel like there's a way you can use it to teach those that are watching when you receive the award that they should learn something from it? I mean, what can they take from it that you would tell them about, you know, working hard, as you said, you learned on the farm?
Well, when I deliver my few remarks, I'm going to look down at my kids and say to them, well, at least I hope you see I had a few accomplishments in my life, or at least I made a lot of friends, one of the two. But you know, I think for a lot of young people today, it's understanding that there's no substitute for hard work, putting in the hours, learning, doing, trying, making mistakes, trying again, because we made lots of mistakes at Office Mate, tons of them. But we always made sure that we didn't make critical mistakes that we couldn't recover from. And, you know, I look at my own kids and they're hard workers. I think they understand hard work the way I do, although I don't think there's any substitute for growing up on a farm and, you know, working, driving tractors and cutting grass. And, you know, that was an education that you can't buy in today's world. But, you know, again, hard work, commitment, sincerity, building relationships, those are to me all the fundamental things that I've used throughout my whole life.
Yeah, it's a nice way to circle back to what we spoke about earlier. Because you come from the hard work of driving the tractor and having lunch brought to you and learning how to respect your elders and all those things, you want to see the world like that. But I alluded to a few minutes ago that optometry is changing. Our students are coming out prepared to do care that many of us educated 30 years ago or more have only dabbled in, and they seem to be putting in the hard work. They seem to be willing and able to take on the care that we've all given, but it's a very different market. The practices don't always afford the doctors ownership, you know, from a business perspective. I would guess that you would have some advice for them. I know it's hard work, but is it, I'm trying to understand what you're saying. I think it's focusing on the right things, right? Not writing out the recall cards, but getting clear about what the right things are so they can be successful in the eye care space.
Well, I think it's developing business skills. As you well know, all the schools focus on the clinical side, but there's very little focus on the business side. And, you know, I think every student coming out has to decide which track he or she would like to go down. If they want to stay in the clinical world, there's plenty of opportunities. But to me, you know, my word of advice would be understand the business side of optometry. And I think there are ample opportunities to do that in today's world, online, going to, you know, the SECOs and the Vision Expos and all the events and all the business, you know, courses that are given. If there's the desire is there to learn, the opportunity is there.
And to show that you really always wore that educator or want to be educator badge very proudly, at GPN, you started something called GPN Visions. It's this commitment to sharing information with the profession without an expectation of them of paying you for it or being a customer of your software. And I commend you for doing that. Let's kind of get to that at the end here. Why do you feel so strongly that you can provide that information in the sea of other offerings? And my hunch is it's better than many of the other offerings out there. Why do you do that? Is it to improve these doctors' ability to get to that education you're talking about right then?
Well, without any doubt, that's the purpose. And, you know, we our customer care team answers so many questions about KPIs and data. And we thought, let's start GPN Visions and, you know, all of the contributors. And we've got fabulous contributors. And thank you, you included in that contributor list. We don't pay them. They in turn share our desire to teach and help people learn about the profession. And, you know, again, we ask doctors and staff to subscribe, but there's no fee for it. We want them to grow, to be successful, to use the tools that are available to them.
Well, it's an incredible commitment. I guess the last thing I'd ask you is to reflect on those people that worked alongside you, including those that do today. I know you give them a lot of credit for the things you've been given credit for in their accomplishment in your accomplishments. Tell me about the teams you've been around and with and what they mean to you.
Well, I've had phenomenal teams. And to me, I see myself as a maestro, you know, in front of the orchestra, quietly not doing anything other than leading the orchestra. And the team, the orchestra, they make the beautiful music. I'm just the guy that can put the right people in the right seats. And that's a lesson I've learned over the years. But, you know, I think at Office Mates, certainly at Eyefinity, and today at GPN, we have the best teams we could possibly have. And I would put them up against any team and any business in the industry. And it's so, you know, what's my skill? Being the maestro, not being the doer, is getting the right people. So I don't have to sit and fill out recall cards. I have somebody doing that for me.
Well, I think there's some sort of adage that talks about great leaders actually promote great teams and great people go toward great leaders because they're given the opportunity to become their fullest, you know, self. And I'm sure that's what you've extracted out of them. So as an educator, as a salesperson and so forth, I would think that Charlie would be pretty proud. Do you agree?
I think he would be. And certainly in the early days, I don't think he was so proud of me, but I think he would be today. He had very high standards in the early days. There's no doubt about it. And I was a young, you know, teenager, and, you know, I had other things on my mind, not being successful in life. But yeah, yes, he would be very proud of me, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Any final thoughts as you think about getting your award and getting ready to, you know, sort of close those chapters in your career that you want to share with us?
Nope, I'm ready to I'm ready to be the goober of the grandkids and to spend time with them and sort of, this sounds a little morbid, but write my own eulogy, because, you know, your kids won't think of you as office mate or this industry executive. They're going to think of you as dad and pops. And so, you know, I want to give back to my family, because for so many years I took from them, you know, in building my career. So now it's time to sort of shift and give back to them.
That's wonderful. Ed Buffington, let me again congratulate you on your 2024 honor as Person of Vision. Thank you for all you've done for the industry, and thank you for your willingness to share your many stories with me today on Sandbox Stories.
And my pleasure, Scott. Thank you for our professional and personal relationship over the years. It's been terrific. Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure, Ed. And to the audience, thanks for attending. I think you have appreciated Ed's many stories. And until my next Sandbox story, be great at all you do.